Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will speak about the impact of remote work on urban development. Joining me for this discussion are Fabian Stefani, who is non-resident fellow at Bruegel and research lecturer at the Oxford Internet Institute, and Monica Stevens, who is assistant professor in the Department of Geography at Durham University. Monica, Fabian, thank you for joining The Sound of Economics. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Likewise, I'm doing fine. Thanks for the invitation, Giuseppe.
And I would like to remind our listeners that this episode is part of our series linked to the Bruegel Research Program on the Future of Work and Inclusive Growth. Back to the issue we want to discuss today. Remote working, or teleworking, or as they call it in Italy, smart working. Someone one day will have to explain me why my co-nationals calls it that way. It is here to stay. And a lot has been speculated on how it might change individuals' habits, but also how it would impact people's mobility and localization. All of a sudden, after the pandemic, 1960s predictions seem to be finally come true, such as the one stated by the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, who said that in the year 2000, we would have all been working from Tahiti. Remote work is here to stay, but while many of us could work from anywhere, the urbanization of digital work has been continuing in the past few years. Cities are becoming the mega hubs for online mediated work. But what will this change bring to our cities and the rural regions that are left behind? This is what we would like to explore during this episode, and I would like to first start by asking both of you to provide our listeners some background on the longer-term evolution of the major topic that we are discussing here, which is the interaction between where people who are working are located and the mobility of jobs and itself, what kind of impact it has on specialization and geography. Maybe, Fabian, would you like to start?
Sure. So obviously this is a really big topic. There are loads of things that you could, loads of angles that you could have a look, from at this, let's say, because it's actually various topics. So it's like digitalization of work. So we work more and more with digital technologies. And then in the special case, that some of these digital technologies are remote working, or as you said, in Italy, they say smart working technologies. So they allow you to work from a different place, maybe where you're company is, or where your coworkers or your colleagues are. And there's been accordingly also a lot of work going on, in particular just at my department at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford, various scholars looking at that, looking at how these technologies impact society, how they impact our work, how specific forms of this remote work impact our lives. For example, platform work. We probably have a bit of time to talk about what platform work is. So essentially work that's mediated, digital work that's mediated by a large scale online platforms. And of course, there has also been the additional kind of complication, though also researchers would probably could call it also welcome the experiment or experimental setting of the pandemic that changed a lot of things, you know, that changed a lot of habits where people that might have not liked to work from home or might have not been allowed to work from home by their employers all of a sudden had to do that because there was no other option but working from home. And so maybe just to start with two findings that we made that I had the privilege to be part of in our department. One was the work that we did during the pandemic, essentially, where we looked at workers, platform workers, so people that do these types of online mediated jobs, graphic designers, software developers, or people working in marketing and accounting, and where we saw that some of this work got more and more outsourced to these platforms. So went more and more decentralized, where it had previously been potentially be carried out in companies. And for some occupations, that was not the case. And there are some very specific, you know, economic dynamics that stand behind this, why some type of work is more prone to be outsourced via online platforms and some is not. And the other thing is a study that, that I took part in, led by my colleague Fabian Brezeman, where we looked at, these platforms globally on a global scale. So in more than 150 countries all around the world. And where we realized that more and more this type of work, this type of remote work, it's a special type of remote work, but it's a very borderless work, is actually has a distinct geography. So it's distinctly distributed across the world. It's more prevalent in some countries than in others. And one of the strong findings, and I think you alluded to that already in the beginning, is that much of this work, even though it could potentially be carried out from everywhere where you have a stable internet connection, at least, is that this is not the case. It's happening in cities. So the it seemed to, at least, that the more remote, the more flexible in terms of location this work is, the more it's actually moving to cities, which we found was a very interesting and sometimes somehow kind of a counterintuitive finding. But I don't know, maybe we have some more time to see why it's not that counterintuitive.
Maybe before hearing from Monica, you mentioned the relation with outsourcing, and perhaps it's worth to elaborate a little bit more. So you basically are saying that the wave of remote working could be associated with the waves of outsourcing, which have been starting way before the remote working as we know it, like post-pandemic kind of remote working. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's I would say it's linked to both economic phenomena that have emerged kind of before we all got accustomed to sitting in front of a computer and working via Zoom or something like that. And this is outsourcing. So taking a certain task that has previously been happening within your company, let's say, for example, an accounting task, and transferring this to another company, maybe a daughter company, or maybe an external provider of this service that is more efficient for whatever reasons, economic reasons, in performing this, and you can save costs by outsourcing this. Typical examples are that you do this for accounting tasks, for example, and then it's combined with another economic phenomenon that is offshoring. So that means not only are you taking this to another company, but this company or this factory maybe is not located nearby. It might be located in a different country, might be even located on a completely different at the other side of the planet. And this is driven by, at least to a large extent, economic motivations. Costs, you can cut costs. You know, you can arbitrage that living costs, working costs are lower in other countries than in the one where your company originally is located. And this is, of course, we see a facilitation of this or a crossover of these effects when we look at remote work, because this work, particularly the work that we looked at, this kind of platform related work is absolutely borderless in that sense. You know, it could be done from anywhere. Theoretically speaking, it could be done from anywhere around the world. So I don't know if you Giuseppe say like you have a little company and you want somebody to design a logo for your new brand, you could hire somebody who's in Bangalore, who's in the Philippines, who's in Sydney, who's in Rio de Janeiro to do this work for you, as long as it's completely digitally transferable, this type of work. So yes, it's a continuation of this trend of both outsourcing and offshoring.
I will come back to some policy and legal implication of what you just said, but I would like to ask Monica what's her view, because you've been digging the digital world and trying to map it out on the physical space somehow. As far as I understood, you've been concentrating quite a lot your research on what's going on social media, for example, and how this has some implications in the way people are located on the map. So how do you find what just heard from Fabian related to the kind of things that you've been digging in so far?
And that was a great introduction, Fabian. That was a really great overview of what's been going on. So thank you for sharing all of that. I'm learning a lot. One of the things that we found in our work is that there's always going to be an urban agglomeration of whatever digital data you're looking at. You're pulling from any social media feed, even when you normalize for population, you're going to find that there are more hosts, there's more content, there's more digital content in cities than in their rural counterparts. And even accounting for population, there's about 20% more content in cities. So there's actually, despite this ability for anyone to work anywhere, produce content anywhere, it is not simply a factor of like rural populations have less population alone, or rural areas have less population alone, that cities have more content, that people are producing more when they're within cities digitally. And so you can see lots of traces of metadata of that. And even during the pandemic, again, you still saw the larger the city, the more content was being created there. And this is across the board. You also have various other reasons that within cities, it's very uneven where people are creating content. Within cities, the speed of the internet may differ between different regions. You may have racial divisions. You may also have this division of who is able to work remotely and create content during different parts of the day versus creating content only at night. And you have this in rural areas as well, of if you are working a job in a factory or you're working as a farmer in the field, you may not have the ability to be creating media during the workday. So it just depends on your position and what you are doing and your ability to create content.
That's actually pretty interesting, if I may just jump in, because the thing is, so thanks for broadening the picture here, Monica, because I've been, of course, only talking about the digital traces, if you want to call it like that, that we've been collecting. So the digital breadcrumbs of remote workers, that's what we've been looking at. But what you're saying is that apparently there seems to be you said 20%, if I remember correctly, it's like kind of a 20% activity premium, even if you control for the size of the population going on in cities. And we have to some extent similar numbers. For example, in global South countries, we found that there is, just looking at the capital region, so not looking at cities in general, but the capital region of the country, which is very often the largest urban agglomeration, we see that even for population, the chances of finding a platform worker, a remote worker, like a fully online worker, are 15 times higher in this capital. It's a smaller number in OECD countries. It's like 3 to 4 times higher, but still there is an obvious, you know, even when you control for population size, there seems to be an obvious, for the lack of a better word, I call it activity premium for these urban regions.
If I may jump in, so basically at the end of the pandemic, or while still during the pandemic itself, there was a lot of fear of a mass exodus of professional work and talent to these offshoring destinations. And in theory, I mean, you just mentioned it, in theory, this online mediated work should fully subordinate to the logic of outsourcing and offshoring that you've been sketching. However, Fabian, you've been recently examining that borderless work actually migrates towards the city. I mean, that's pretty much consistent story over there. Now, I would like to elaborate a little bit more on that, but also I wonder, when it comes to the actual mobility factor of the workers itself, which is something that concerns less maybe the urban part, but more the labor part, is the fact that that workers are still somehow subject to national or state, in the United States, national, federal, or whatever, depending on the polity they are in, or the labor legislation they might have a contract with, they're still bound to their own place of signing the contract too. I'm making the example of Belgium, for example, where of course you can work virtually from anywhere in Europe, but only up to a certain amount of time. After that, you will have to pay taxes in the other country and not taxes in Belgium. Or when it comes to social security, you know, which is strictly linked with the taxes situation, or other welfare state services such as unemployment benefits, health insurance, and so forth. So this myth of the big mobility, that all of a sudden everyone could have been working from a remote, small, nice, cute village which has been deserted in the middle of the Apennine in central Italy, or from the Canary Island on the other side of the geography of the continent, actually is more challenging than it is. So it seems to me that there are several things at work over there. So we've seen that instead of migrating out of the city, actually these new jobs that are more mobile seems to work inside the city. What did you find out when in your own research?
So, I mean, we didn't observe migration in the sense that we follow people over time and they had been working in the countryside, and then the next time point, the next month, we see them working in the city. So the work migration, if I had used that, was more a bit of had a more loose connotation, in the sense that over time, we observe in aggregate that more work is of this flexible work, the work that's geographically flexible, is more and more happening in cities. And I, to some extent, I'm speculating here when I say that it's probably the attraction of the city that pulls workers in the sense that there's just more going on in the cities that might be interesting, particularly for the people that do this type of work, so that are maybe a bit more affluent or more interested in finding a certain cultural vibe and in finding a certain cultural activity. But also, I mean, let's be frank, I think we can all relate, if we think of all three are countries of origin, that it's just there are also, besides culture, certain attractions in the city, just in terms of infrastructure. So there are probably better schools available in cities. There might be better, definitely better. It's the problem, for example, where I come from originally, there's more close or dense provision of healthcare, for example, than in some rural areas. So I think these are definitely forces that pull people towards the city. That's what I would be assuming. But then there are also, of course, hard facts. So it's still, particularly in the global South context, still the case that for remote work, it might sound trivial to us, but I think we should still remember that half of the world's population, at least that's what I remember so far, does not have access to stable internet. So in the cities, if in a country you find stable internet, you're most likely to find it in the urban areas. And that's might be just one of the simple hard facts explaining why people then, if they work online or more work online, that they tend to work from the city. We find them more in cities.
Yeah, I just want to add that workers aren't solo people, like, to that they have spouses and partners, they have children. Their spouses likely have jobs as well. A lot of internet isn't great when you have two or three Zoom calls happening at the same time. So those partners also have to find work, and they may not be necessarily work from home or remote workers themselves. So a remote worker and a teacher together, that teacher has to still teach in a school that's located somewhere. They can't be necessarily anywhere. And the assumption that a worker can relocate anywhere is again, assuming that the worker is spatially mobile, and that gets rid of the messiness that families bring into this. That children bring into this, that you gave the example of where you could only work somewhere for a few months before they had to relocate. That doesn't work if you have a child who attends school. You know, if a child is attending school, especially a young child, that child needs to be attending school for several months in the same school. You can't move between locations every 3 months, as much as that might be very fun to do. So people's lives are a lot more complex, and that complexity is often met within cities rather than, you know, rural areas where people are often fully already employed within that rural environment. They have jobs in maintaining the rural community that they live in. I think you also had mentioned issues with the sort of tax structures as well. I'm currently in the United States, New York State taxes and the companies of remote workers, if they have been in the US for more than 3 months, or in New York State, particularly for more than 3 months, for the costs of that person. Because, of course, New York still has to maintain roads and schools for all these remote workers, and can't pay for these things when all their taxes are going elsewhere. So that creates a challenge for some companies that aren't already incorporated in New York.
So Monica, you bring forward the other big element into the room, which is if there is a concentration of these remote workers, what does it actually change in the way a city is organized? So instead of scaling the debate over whether the work is being located anywhere, if we are speaking about the fact that there is an increase of remote workers within the urban centers, what does it mean for the changes of those cities? I think this is a fascinating question, to see how actually this change in habits can change or has already been starting to change, I don't know, the housing market, or you mentioned about families, so childcare or other aspects which are linked to this new kind of work-life balance, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was amazed at the beginning of the pandemic, and when all the schools closed, children were home, everybody's jobs, if they could, transitioned to being remote work. How many employers were not flexible to the idea of there being children at home, or that is a full-time job of caring for children in addition to whatever other employment you were previously maintaining and relying on schools for employment. And a lot of people, especially within dense urban cores at the beginning of the pandemic, didn't have the space within their homes for that flexibility. People were remotely working from their bedrooms. People were remotely homeschooling from their kitchens. You were seeing people even trying to do those at the same time. And there was a lot of challenges, and that challenges often were extraordinarily stressful for members of the family.
The interesting thing that I noticed, if I may just jump in on what Monica said, is that there is actually another, from my point of view, there's actually another puzzle going on, because Giuseppe, you said so people can now work from everywhere. Why don't they go to Bali or to Tahiti, right? And we see that this is really, really not happening. But then the other thing that came up just earlier was, if now everybody has access and flexibility in terms of working whenever you want, you know, from wherever you want, why don't we see a convergence in terms of how much people earn, or what kind of jobs people do? And actually, in some cases, we still see, so for example, there's an interesting study being done, I think, about a year ago or just slightly after the pandemic by my colleague in Oxford, Abigail Adams-Brussel, who looked at the wage gap, the gender wage gap on these platforms, specifically on a specific platform, which is Amazon Mechanical Turk, if I remember this correctly. So click work, essentially, relatively simple tasks that are outsourced and also potentially offshored online. And you might think that, why is there still a gender pay gap? You know, the tasks are so similar. So because often the argument is like, okay, men might earn more because the economists don't get it right. You know, they're not able to calculate that people are doing different things. But that's all not the case. And interestingly, to make a long story short, what she found in the end is that there is a certain wage premium of flexibility on just when a job comes up, that people are able to say, like, I'll take it immediately. And I'll do it immediately, even if it's 3 o'clock at night, or even if it's six, no matter what time it is. And she found out that for some parts of the population, of the workers' population on these platforms, this is just not possible because they have other important things to do. They have to take care of family members. They have to take care of children. And in the kind of conventional, in the conventional setting, this is still very often more likely to be the case for women and for men. And she found out that actually explains a lot of the wage gap in the end, because they were not able to harvest this premium because they were not as flexible. Our discussion reminded me of this work, because it kind of tells us interestingly that whenever we think of the internet and things happening digitally somewhere in the cloud, we think like, okay, now everything changes. But the actual conditions that we live in, be they spatial or social, they all creep in back again, and sometimes even much stronger than they were in the, let's say, in the analog world or in the non-digital world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we find basically the same kind of questions that we would have had without the digital element with the situation we are in. So you're completely right on that. But coming back to the theme of the city, I think that there is a change if there is a change in the way people are working there will be a change, or there is a change in the way they are using the cities themselves. And I think this is an interesting topic, especially for people studying how the cities are planned or serviced and functioning. And somehow it connects the debate over the future work with the debate on green cities, smart cities, you know, how technology itself is going to help the cities to transform themselves in the challenges that we are going to have, how we're going to rethink the way we are working, not only working, but also living, and the interaction between these two elements. Monica, do you want to add something on that?
Back to the gendered component of, there still needs to be some role for childcare. So there's been several initiatives to include childcare with work, and to have employers who have childcare facilities on site. And there's several different legislative cures that legislators and government are trying to pull to ensure that there is adequate childcare, so that more women and more people who are currently caring for their own children can enter the workforce and resolve some of this labor shortage. But when you start talking about work from home, it creates an issue with, where are these child centers going to be distributed? Where are these kids going to be cared for? And that is based on not necessarily where the employers are located, but where the workers are located and where the workers are living if they are working from their home. So that creates another dimension within the urban planning, and it still has people transporting or commuting somewhere, either driving or taking public transit to bring their kids to childcare and then to return home to work from home. It doesn't really resolve as much of the sort of green goals that we may have of reducing people commuting and transporting things within the city.
Fabian, we've been speaking about the cities, but the other side of the coin is the rural areas. So this is also what we haven't seen. We haven't seen a movement towards the rural areas all of a sudden because we could work from anywhere. So what to do with that? What do we make of it? But also, what does it mean for those rural regions who are not only were already disadvantaged and maybe less prone to host high-talented, skilled digital workers, but that continue to see this kind of movement for deserting them?
So there are two things coming to my mind. Of course, that was kind of the maybe the original promise or the original idea that you say, okay, now that work can be done from anywhere, potentially, at least that's now it's the time for the rural regions to shine, you know, to people move back because, hey, you know, we can get out of the hot cities. They get hotter and hotter, but unfortunately, you know, every year, as we also see, and be in touch with nature, have more free time, have more space, pay less rents. And we did not see this happening. We see an accelerating urbanization. And so we seem to conclude that the flexibility is kind of a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition for people to move. They could move. The reason is, one, of course, infrastructure. So one of the hard facts, again, and I think Monica, who's more knowledgeable on this than I am, there is a gap in terms of infrastructure. There is still parts where you do not have stable or mobile internet. Let's not forget, for example, in a different setting than ours, for example, in OECD countries or in the United States or Western Europe, often people do not work, even if they work on these platforms, they do not work on a laptop. They work on a phone, on a smartphone. And so they need mobile internet. And that is sometimes even more difficult to be found than the discussions that one could have, whether people should have fiber cable in their little community or in their little village. And then on the other hand, there are what I would call soft factors. Maybe that's not a good word, but for lack of a better word, the soft factors, in the sense like, okay, but what's happening in the countryside? Are there the schools that I want for my kids? Is there a doctor nearby when I need one for my parents who might be living with me, who are now old and need a regular visit, have to go to the doctor regularly? Or is there a cinema? You know, is there a theater? Are there interesting things happening? And of course, this is probably maybe, I would guess, I mean, it's just a question maybe for us, this is probably more difficult even to be established than the hard factors, the infrastructure factors, where maybe we'll find satellite solutions or whatever to give stable internet access infrastructure to the countryside. But what about these cultural societal factors? And I think they need to be there as well, because otherwise people will still find the city more attractive. And I think the scenario where the city is becoming so unattractive that people are pushed towards the countryside, that can't be a sustainable solution. It should be a pull of the rural regions who might not be that rural then anymore to attract people, I guess.
Thank you, Fabian. We could go on to discuss for much longer. However, we are almost done with the time that we have for this episode. But before leaving, I would like to ask Monica if you would like to have any last comments to what we've been hearing so far, and then close.
I think that one thing to add is that rural regions don't always have the capacity to necessarily take on a huge number of remote workers. I grew up in the rural state of Vermont, and my family still lives there and owns a engineering firm, and their firm needs to bring employees in from out of state to do work on machines, to do things like that. And they have trouble recruiting them recently because there's no housing available for these employees. There's no housing even remotely within their price range. A lot of the housing has gone towards Airbnb. It's very idyllic, very beautiful. And then the other housing has gone because the state has several incentives to bring remote workers in to relocate to this rural state. And they've offering something like $5,000, and they've brought in hundreds and hundreds of people, and just, you know, this is again in the hundreds range, not in the thousands range, to buy houses and become remote workers from that remote state. But that leaves very little housing for the companies that exist that already need to bring in employees, that have employees who need housing and need these practical things. And it creates a struggle for them to recruit and retain employment because it isn't very feasible to move there. They don't have the capacity within that rural environment to maintain these employees. So there's a lot of restrictions on how houses can be built, and they shouldn't be built to be empty. But at the same time, private property precludes workers from relocating necessarily. So that was all I wanted to add.
So definitely quite some food for thought for both urban planners on one side and administrators of rural regions, but also to national, federal policymakers, because this whole thing poses greater questions about what we call in the European Union jargon convergence of different territories or cohesions of different territories within the same sets of polities that might be linked together. So definitely this is something that we should continue to look at from these different angles, from the labor angle, the digital angle, the urban planning angle, but also these other fields which are all interconnected. I would like to thank both of you, Monica and Fabian, for this very enriching conversation today. And I would like to remind our listeners that this episode was part of our series linked to Bruegel Research Program on the Future Work and Inclusive Growth, and that as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Monica, Fabian, thanks a lot again, and thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Giuseppe. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.